Today's headlines offer a good example of the economic news of our time. Experts pointing to a couple of figures like the stock market and home sales and saying things look pretty good in the economy. While some people reading those headlines wonder why the good economic effects do not reach them. And another news item shows that more millennials live with their parents than in any other living arrangement. How did we get here? Our guest this hour offers a number of answers. Rana Faruhar wrote the book Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. Rana Faruhar is assistant managing editor of economics and business at Time Magazine and an analyst of global economic issues for CNN. In her spare time, she's also a contributor to New York public radio station WNYC. And if that's not enough, she also pops up from time to time on news shows on other broadcast and cable networks, obviously now including this one. Rana Faruhar, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I feel like my mother wrote that bio.
She might have written part of it. I did crib a little bit of it from your stuff. The concept in this book of regulatory capture looms large, even in the moment that you say sparked the book, this 2013 off-the-record briefing.
Yeah,
what happened there?
So I had a 2013 briefing with an Obama administration official, ex-official at that point, who'd been, you know, intimately involved in the bailouts. And one of the things I was interested in at the time is how much lobbying the financial industry had been doing to try and push back the Dodd-Frank banking regulation. You might remember that that's
sure.
The post-crisis regulation. And, you know, they'd really made Swiss cheese out of some of it. And in particular, there was a rule called the Volcker Rule, which was supposed to separate out the risky trading part of banks from the plain vanilla, it's a wonderful life kind of lending. And, you know, I asked the official what he thought about this effort on the part of the financial system. And he said, well, you know, we think that the regulation's actually been crafted very well and they haven't had an effect. And I pointed out that actually public records showed that 93% of all of the meetings about the Volcker Rule had been taken with the financial industry themselves. And so I said to him, how could this possibly be the case when 93% of all the voices in the room were bankers? And he looked at me with real befuddlement and said, well, who else should we have spoken to? And I just thought, wow, there's not only all this lobbying pressure, but there's such a cognitive capture on the part of many public officials that finance is the game. You know, it's the center of the economic universe, and it needs to be protected at all costs. And my book would argue that it's just the opposite, that finance really needs to be just a helpmeet to business if we want to get back to sustainable growth.
So when we get into the overall issue of finance versus business, I mean, what is going on now that didn't used to happen?
Well, so the killer stat in my book is that only 15% of all the financial flows coming out of big banks and financial institutions in the U.S. today are actually going into Main Street business investment. And when you think about it, when you step back and say, well, how did Adam Smith want capitalism to function? The idea was that banks are supposed to take all of our savings in the form of deposits and hold those deposits and then lend them out to productive new enterprises, businesses that would then create jobs and economic growth and help to grow an overall economy sustainably. But today, only 15% of those financial flows in banks are going to real businesses. Now, what's the rest doing? It's existing in this closed loop of trading in assets like stocks and bonds and houses, speculation. You know, we've had a sea change in the way the capital markets work. And I think that that's one of the reasons, one of the unexplored reasons, actually, that we're in the longest, slowest recovery of the post-war era.
So, Rana, did the role of finance become irresistible because you can make money without having to make anything?
Well, that's a big part of it. I mean, it's interesting because pre-2008, particularly the profit margins of financial institutions were just enormous, you know, in the high double digits. They've gone down a little bit at the traditional institutions since then, in part because there was some regulation passed that allowed them to or forced them to hold more capital against risk. But risk has just spread into other areas of banking, into shadow banking, into hedge funds, into private equity. I mean, one of my favorite chapters in the book actually looks at the housing market and how a private equity company, Blackstone, is now the largest owner of single-family housing in the U.S. It's the biggest landlord in the U.S., a private equity firm. Now, why is that? That's because it was allowed to go in with very little regulatory oversight, post-2008 and buy up all the houses that went under on the courthouse steps and then make money from it. So finance made money before the crash, during the crash, and after the crash.
And from the crash, it sounds like.
And from the crash, exactly.
Well, yeah, the thing you just mentioned, though, where you got the equity firms buying up housing, comes in a much later chapter of the book about Wall Street owns Main Street. And there's a great example here in Riverside County, California, which is still reeling from the effects of the housing bubble bursting, but rents are climbing anyway.
Exactly. That was one of the really stunning things to me. So I would go into these communities. I spent a lot of time in California, actually, in a number of very beleaguered communities that were hit hard by the housing crisis. And, you know, you see these properties coming back, and then you'd notice, well, rents are higher than they should be. Why is that? Because unemployment is still double-digit in some cases. That doesn't make economic sense. If unemployment is high, people aren't doing well, you'd expect rents to be low. But no, and that's because of this trend of finance coming in, being a remote landlord. And there's been a number of activist groups that have written papers and research reports about how problematic this is to have these remote landlords. People can't even communicate with them if there's a problem, oftentimes. And this is just one of the many examples of how finance has come to dominate the real economy rather than supporting it.
There's a couple of key phrases that really ring out in the book, and one of them is you saying that debt is the lifeblood of finance, and I have to believe this is why our dogs get offers to get credit cards.
That's right. And it's why, you know, we have student debt that's even higher than credit card debt in this country. It's interesting because debt is where finance makes money. It makes money by issuing debt. And if you look at the rise of the financial sector, which is about doubled in size since the 1970s, it has coincided with the rise of debt in America, both at the corporate level, the public level, and the consumer level. And one of the reasons that so much debt has been issued is really down to this deep political economy crisis in the 1970s. The growth basically in the U.S., underlying growth, Main Street growth, started to slow in the 1970s. And, you know, for some reasons, that was natural. We had Europe rising, the emerging markets rising. But rather than take real decisions about how to affect that, how to make that Main Street grow more sustainably, policymakers threw the ball to the markets, let them issue as much debt as possible, let them make people feel wealthier on paper rather than dealing with those real issues.
Gee, sounds all like the 1990s and the 2000s and all that led up. Yeah, okay. Makers and Takers is the name of Rana Faruhar's book. We'll come back and talk more with her and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Reinley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Rana Faruhar from Time Magazine and CNN and WNYC, among others. She has just written a book called Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. Talks about the financialization of American industry, how so much more of the economy now is people shuffling paper around to create wealth, at least on paper. And not as much on the other aspects of the economy. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. So the first example you give in the book is about Apple, cash rich in 2013, borrowing billions of dollars. Why?
Yeah, it's this incredibly Kafkaesque story, which really illustrates just how disconnected the markets have become from Main Street. So a few years back, Apple started issuing a lot of bond offerings in the U.S., so basically issuing debt in order to not invest in factories or workers or R&D, but to basically pay back shareholders. So they would use this money to do share buybacks, which means going into the open market, buying back up your shares, and that always jacks up the price of the stock because it artificially decreases the number of stocks on the market. CEOs love to do this. Companies love to do it. It's a quick way to get a short-term boost in your share price. And it enriches, you know, basically the top 10% of the country that owns 80% of the stocks. The majority of this wealth goes to the C-suite of the companies that are doing these kinds of deals. And it's not just Apple. We've had record amounts of share buybacks in the last 2 years. It also goes to activist investors, people like Carl Icahn, which actually encouraged Apple to do a lot of this. Now, what was so ironic is Apple is the most cash-rich large company in the country. I mean, it has got $200 billion of money sitting in bank accounts, but much of it is offshore because they don't want to bring the money back and pay the U.S. corporate tax rate on it. So you have this great irony of a company that doesn't need any capital being more involved than ever in the capital markets in a way that I think is really sort of destructive to underlying economic growth.
So if they'd brought their own cash onshore, they would have been liable for taxation?
That's right. And, you know, a lot of companies complain that the U.S. tax rate is too high. That's, you know, kind of another story. My book shows that actually the U.S. tax rate is not preventing private companies from investing in the U.S. markets. It is preventing public companies in some ways because they're more vulnerable to shareholder pressure, which again shows just how perverse the market incentives have become. If you don't do things that bolster your share price in the quarter, your investors will cut you off. That's why the CEOs these days of public companies have a 3-year lifespan. Private companies, on the other hand, invest about twice as much into Main Street, and their growth is much more sustainable because they're not dealing with this perverse market pressure.
Are private companies putting more into research and development too? Because you point out that's a failing of public companies.
They are. They are. And again, that's because they're freer to take the long view. If you look at since the 1980s, as finance has doubled in size, you can chart almost a perfect X with the increase in the size of the financial industry, the increase in the number of share buybacks, and then the fall of R&D, the fall in the number of startups, the fall in entrepreneurial zeal in this country, and in real risk-taking, which is the basis of true economic growth.
Companies would no doubt say that they really are in a position where they have to boost the share price. I mean, you pointed out the 3-year lifespan of CEOs,
yeah.
So your head's on the table if you have a couple of bad quarters, maybe even one.
Yeah, well, that and, you know, this gets to this 40-year period that I talked about where it's not just about the size of banks or too-big-to-fail banks. There's been a number of policy decisions taken over the last few years that have resulted in this perverse system of incentives that creates short-termism in corporate America. So one decision I would point to, actually, during the Clinton years, there was a discussion about growing inequality, and a lot of people in the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton's administration, like Joe Stiglitz, for example, were really concerned about the growing pay gap between CEOs and workers. And so a cap was put in on CEO pay, so you could not give out cash pay for more than $1 million and have that be tax deductible. But certain other members of the Clinton administration, like Treasury Secretary Bob Rubin, actually argued for a loophole for incentive pay that would be paid out in options, in stock options. And that was passed through, and then stock option pay has just boomed. So now you have CEOs making anywhere from 50 to 80% of their pay in stock options. Well, of course, they have every incentive to want to drive that short-term share price of the company up rather than, say, you know, make the kind of investments in R&D, those expensive investments in new factories and capital equipment that would actually drive the share price down in the short term but maybe pay off in 5, 10, 15 years.
Rana Faruhar is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. Let me take just a little dog leg off on the issue of CEO pay here, because if they inflate, if they have a good enough quarter that the stock price goes up, or a good enough day, for that matter, that the stock price goes up, it's still unrealized gain, isn't it, until they make a strike price agreement?
Well, it's interesting. It can be unrealized gain, and there are certainly provisions that have been put in to try and make it so that CEOs can't realize the value of their options until a certain period of time or over a certain period of years. But, you know, it's all part of this vortex of trading. It just speeds up the system. The fact that you have companies trying to manipulate share prices in this way is all part of the growth of trading. It's part of the growth of securitization. It's gone hand in hand with the riskier part of the banking system growing and loans shrinking. So if you look at how the securities part of finance has grown, it's grown about 5 times since the 1980s, whereas actual bank deposits have fallen. So again, we just have a capital market system that sort of exists to serve itself rather than to serve real Main Street businesses.
Which then leads to what you talk about, where the growing financial system slows the growth of the overall economy. Does the presence then of uber-rich people raking in money like the CEOs leave less available for the
It absolutely does. I mean, if you look at charts of how the wealth share of the top 10% has grown relative to the bottom 90, it absolutely shows that. If you look at since 1980 onwards, the majority of the country, a tiny majority, has taken most of the wealth, and I would argue that it's because of these policy changes that have happened over 40 years. And unfortunately, there's not one silver bullet to fix them, because they go across not only the structure of banking, the way we pay CEOs, but also tax policy, housing policy, the way our retirement is structured. So it's a really complex system.
So help me figure out how the trickle-down theory, which has been many times over by many economists, keep hanging around.
Well, things change very slowly in academe. So you go to school, you study economics these days, or you go get an MBA. Efficiency theory is what you're being taught as the core curriculum. It's kind of amazing, because if the last 8 years have taught us anything, it's that markets are really not all that efficient. But you still go and take an Econ 101 class, and that's what you're going to be taught. And, this has very deep roots in MBA programs. They've been teaching that finance is the most important part of the economy for some time. Your typical MBA student comes out thinking he or she should marshal capital, really conserve capital, make sure that you're getting the lowest price on everything, and not think so much about how workers are being treated. Is a community growing organically? But, a lot of business leaders that I speak to are beginning to question that. So one of the interviews I did in my book was with Mark Bertolini, who's the head of Aetna. And he went into his company, and there were a lot of customer service complaints when he came in about, people calling up and just not being able to get what they needed from their healthcare system, long holds, really inefficient service. And he thought, well, why is that? And he started really digging, and he had to dig for several months to find out that 80% of the people, the customer service representatives on the front lines of business that were fielding calls from customers, didn't have health care. They were single mothers who were working, and maybe on public benefits. I mean, this is amazing for a healthcare company to have 80% of its frontline workers not even having healthcare. So one of the things he immediately did, which your typical finance-driven MBA program would have said don't do, is raise wages across the board to $16 an hour. And actually, it's paid off quite well for that company.
So when you said efficiency theory, this is the idea of cutting costs and raising productivity?
It is, and it's also the idea in a broader sense that the markets know best, that if you just leave things to the markets, that they will figure out the best not only economic solution, but ultimately social solution. And I think that that's just proving not to be true. I think we need a broader definition of who companies are run for. They should not be run just on the basis of share price. They should be run for consumers, for workers, for communities. And one thing that's fascinating is a lot of emerging market giants and a lot of European companies that are competing with American companies already have this view. So there's a Chinese web company called Alibaba, for example, that's become very big and popular. And they have an explicit slogan to serve workers first, consumers second, and shareholders third. And that's a way of saying, hey, we're going to take the long view here. We're going to do what's best for the overall economic ecosystem rather than just trying to jack up the share price for the quarter.
If an American company did that, how fast would the stock price fall?
Pretty darn fast, unfortunately. It's interesting, though. One exception to this is founder CEOs. If you get, a Howard Schultz at Starbucks or a Larry Page at Google, sometimes you get people that have such a cult of personality around them that they can push through change and really speak to the investor base in a powerful enough way that companies are able to do things like, in the case of Starbucks, give everybody health care or pay for workers to go back to university, or in the case of Google, really keep their R&D spending rising as a percentage of revenues, which is not the case in many tech companies.
This is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Rana Faruhar from Time Magazine and CNN and WNYC and more is our guest. She's the author of Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. This is the conversation. You're more than welcome to join. Maybe you have some stories about how the economy has affected you, or maybe you have some inner working details about the economy you could share. 800-838-3760 for your questions and comments by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Ann and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. I just finished American Amnesia. One of the authors is Jacob Hacker. I wondered if you were familiar with that book. The other thing is, this is an election year. You may have noticed.
No.
Anyway, so what does your book say to the American voter?
All right.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that question. It's incredibly relevant, actually. I mean, I think my book actually goes a long way towards explaining both Sanders and Trump, and the fact that outsiders on the far left and far right have gained so much traction in this election relative to, say, a more establishment candidate like Hillary Clinton. I think that's because we have had 40 years of changes in the finance system, which is part of the process of globalization, of course, that really haven't served a large number of people. I mean, I grew up in rural Indiana in the Rust Belt, and I saw the hollowing out of the manufacturing sector that happened concurrently with the rise of finance. This process has been really painful, and I think until recently, it was anathema to even say, well, you know, maybe the capital markets aren't working efficiently, or maybe the trade system as it's structured is not working for everybody. This is, by the way, not to say that I think Donald Trump has the answers, don't get me wrong, but I think that the fact that both of these candidates are speaking to things that hit in people's deep felt experience is very much a marker of how broken the system is. And I think one reason that a candidate like Hillary Clinton that, you know, has a lot of very smart white papers and well-thought-out policies about things like financial reform has not been able to get more traction is that a lot of the voter base is just disenchanted with the establishment politics and the establishment political economy, period.
So when Trump, for example, talks about we're going to bring the jobs back from overseas, which appeals to a lot of people, I want to get your take on how closely those things are related, offshoring of jobs and the financialization of the economy. Are they part and parcel of the same thing?
Very much, very much. Because, you know, and it's interesting, these three trends of globalization, technological job destruction, and financialization are very much related. And they exist independently, but they also support and strengthen each other in some ways. So, for example, your typical CFO wants to reduce costs, which would argue for outsourcing. So a lot of companies have been, over the last several decades, as we all know, putting jobs where they're cheapest, be that Mexico, China, the Far East, Eastern Europe, wherever. But that can sometimes lead to problems later on down the line that cost the company more. So Boeing, for example, had some serious problems with its Dreamliner jet because of outsourcing and complicated supply chains that actually delayed the process.
Well, that's right. They're trying to fit parts together from a bunch of disparate manufacturers.
That's right. And actually ended up driving up costs, and then that cost the company money in the public markets. Now, this is a decision that was very financialized, but was it a good financial decision in the long run? No, it was not. That's a perfect example of what we're talking about here.
So you point out through when these changes began to happen in the financial system in the 70s and 80s, and you probably would have caught hell for mentioning Karl Marx in a book then, but you...
It's been trending on Google since 2008, I can tell you.
Why is Karl Marx in this book now?
Well, you know, it's funny. I still catch flack, by the way, for talking about Karl Marx. It's so interesting. You know, Karl Marx was frankly the first person to really explore the deep political economy of financialization. He, of course, considered it to be the last stage of a late stage capitalist society in which eventually a system that he believed was built, you know, primarily on greed would crumble. And, you know, people, the argument, particularly in the laissez-faire 1980s, was, well, that didn't happen. The Berlin Wall fell. You know, we're over that. We're done. We're, you know, post-history now. But I would actually argue that these feedback loops that Marx was talking about can stay in place for a long, long time, that finance creates its own artificial growth that makes everybody feel richer on paper until the bubble bursts. And one thing that the rise of finance also does is make it ensure the fact that we will have financial crises more often. So if you look at the rise of finance and the speeding up of financial crises, they go hand in hand. The bigger the financial sector gets, the more financialized an economy becomes, the more financial crises you have. And by the way, those crises wipe out more growth than anything else aside from, you know, wars or natural disasters. So very, very, very bad for the overall economy.
Rana Faruhar's book is Makers and Takers. There is a disclaimer here. You're not anti-capitalist. Is it fair to say that you're pro-rigorous regulation, though?
Well, I'm pro the right regulation, and I'm pro capitalism that is actually inclusive. You know, I mean, if you go back, again, to Adam Smith, the founder of modern capitalism, he was coming up in a very different period. Most of the businesses then were small and mid-sized enterprises that were family-owned. They were much more rooted in their local economies. Globalization has created a system where you have corporations that fly 35,000 feet above the concerns of national governments, of populations, of workers, and that's created this dichotomy and this space, actually, in which financial arbitrage and profit happens. Unfortunately, it started to actually undermine real growth. And one of the fascinating things that I want to mention is, as I've put this book out there in the world, I've actually gotten a lot of calls from bankers and from financiers themselves that want me to come and talk to them about the thesis, because they are actually worried that it's going to undermine growth and undermine their portfolios in the long run.
The history that you give of the financial sector begs the question whether it always trends toward complexity until no one quite understands it anymore.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, complexity, finance loves complexity. Complexity is where you make money. You know, it's interesting because you often hear in the business pages of the news that business doesn't like uncertainty. Finance doesn't like uncertainty. The markets don't like uncertainty. Well, actually, uncertainty is exactly where the markets make their money. And one of the things that I cover in this book is that the complexity of language in finance and the complexity of the financial debate is one of the reasons we have a system that is as skewed as it is, because just like some academics can use jargon to create a kind of a cult of the insider and keep outsiders out of a certain area, financiers create this very complex dialect. They talk about tier one capital and you know, debt to equity ratios and things that, you know, you need a universal decoder to translate. But actually, the right question is the simplest question. Is banking doing something real and good and measurable for society? And too often the answer is no.
Huh. Much more to talk about with Rana Faruhar. Her book is called Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. We'll come back and take your phone calls and emails for Rana as we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Rana Faruhar, Assistant Managing Editor of Economics and Business at Time Magazine. She's also an analyst of global economic issues for CNN, also appears on WNYC and throughout the broadcasting and cable spectrum. Her book is called Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. This is a lot about what happened in 2008 and could happen again and certainly has happened before. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the financialization of American industry. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let me see if I can pull a couple of issues together into one question here. As I look at things like the response to the crash of 1929 in the book and the history that stemmed out of that, the passing of Glass-Steagall reforms, the repeal of Glass-Steagall completely by 1999. And I think about the fact that when you hear the discussions about how that'll help the overall economy, when you hear about globalization should help everybody, trade helps everybody, it seems like the people who are making those claims and making those decisions are not people who live in a world where people make $25,000 to $50,000 a year.
They're absolutely not. I can tell you that they're not. I mean, you know, these are the people I interview, and they are certainly not those people. And I think that that's one of the problems. You know, there was an interesting study done about a year ago showing that global elites, the people that are making these decisions, have higher levels of trust in each other than ever before in the last few decades. But the public has less trust in elites than ever before. And I think that that speaks directly to your listeners' question about the current political debate. That's why we're seeing this insiders versus outsiders political paradigm. And it's not happening just here in the U.S. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in many parts of Asia. So it is really a global phenomenon.
I wonder, particularly in the case of Donald Trump, though, he may not be a political insider, but he's certainly a financial insider.
He is a financial insider. And it's interesting. I wrote a column for Time called The Confidence Man. If you remember the old Melville novel about The Confidence Man, one of the powers that he has is to take a nugget of truth and embed it in a welter of lies. And I think what's interesting is that Trump does say some things that are true. I mean, he says, you know, free trade has hurt some people. We need to renegotiate deals. We need to think about these things. We need to tax hedge funders more. But ironically, these messages are coming from someone whose commercial real estate deals were amongst the most highly leveraged ever. who is certainly more intimately familiar with Wall Street than any other candidate in modern history, you know, with the possible exception of Mitt Romney. And so it's ironic. I mean, we don't have a perfect choice or a perfect person addressing all the aspects of how broken our capital markets are, certainly. I mean, I would argue actually that Trump, Sanders, and Hillary take a sort of a particular silo, you know, a particular slice of the puzzle, but nobody's putting all the pieces together, and certainly nobody's coming up with all the right policy decisions to address it.
In a chapter called The Rise of Finance, you let us know that it's not just banks that get too big. Why is General Motors, for example, in here?
Well, I put General Motors in because I started looking at that company a few years back when it had a big ignition switch crisis. You may remember that there were some ignition switches that were malfunctioning and a number of people died in car accidents. And as I began investigating that, it became clear that within the company, the left hand didn't know what the right was doing, that the company was very siloed. So the engineers working on one part of the car were separated from the engineers working on another part. And this is a very financialized way of setting a business up because you have different divisions, each with their own balance sheet. Each wants to keep costs low and really control things in its own silo rather than having an organization that works more holistically together. And as I began looking deeper into that, I found that this was really the legacy, interestingly, of Robert McNamara, who was, of course, the head of the failed Vietnam War effort. He was the guy that thought, you know, if we could just measure how many megatons of bombs would take out a certain number of square miles in Vietnam, that we could win the war. Very, very financially oriented, metric oriented thinking. He also happened to run Ford Motors and later ran Harvard Business School. And so his thinking about numbers crunching, balance sheet manipulation really worked their way into corporate America, certainly into the auto industry, where it became the status quo way of doing business, but also into all industries, because the whiz kids who worked under Robert McNamara went on to take on much of blue chip business in America. And it's interesting because I spoke actually with the vice chairman of GM, a guy named Bob Lutz, who wrote a wonderful book called Car Guys versus Bean Counters that looked at just this, you know, the rise of the power of the CFO's office versus the engineer. And all the problems that this can lead to.
Well, and not just at GM. I mean, you give the case study of Hewlett-Packard as well and yeah. What happened when Carly Fiorina was brought in there. But it seems like in all these discussions, it's less about making better products. It's all about buying and selling and cutting parts or divisions, and I mean parts of companies or divisions or, you know, entire companies.
Well, that's right. When you replace real engineering with financial engineering, it gets very difficult to get to the right result. You start to lose the forest for the trees. You know, you're marshaling your capital, but you're not looking out and saying, am I making a wonderful product for customers that they will love and that will make people happy? Are we paying, are we treating our workers well and helping to give them enough money that maybe they can buy those products too? I mean, you know, one thing I remember in the course of researching this book, I spoke to Howard Schultz, and he said to me, you know, we've become a nation of latte makers and latte drinkers. And at some point, in an economy like the U.S., which is based 70% on consumer spending, you better hope you have enough people that can afford those lattes.
Well, that's the weird part for me, is thinking way back to Henry Ford talking about, you know, I need to pay my employees enough to be able to buy my cars. That seems to have been forgotten.
They have been forgotten. I mean, you know, and Henry Ford wasn't perfect either. I mean,
no.
You know, he was very anti-union and
anti-Semitic.
Anti-Semitic, right, exactly. We could go on. But this idea that you can't really have a sustainable recovery in an economy that is based 70% on consumer spending when people haven't gotten a raise in real terms since the early 1990s. The math just doesn't work. That's really important.
Let's take a call from Tony in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rana Faruhar, who is the author of Makers and Takers.
I would argue that the Adam Smith's hidden hand has actually benefited the world. Obviously, you can argue that the Americans are feeling jealous because the rest of the world is doing so much better. But that is the fact. If you make something abroad, it's still being made, it's still being improved, it's still being getting research and everything to improve the product. I doubt whether you really think that people are deliberately making poor products. But I would like to just take up this issue, which is frequently repeated on this channel, about the so-called wage gap. Mm. If you look at the so-called CEO wage gap, of the top 500 S&P companies, the CEOs earn collectively $6 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 6 billion divided by 500. If you were to, in fact, compensate the almost 100,000 rank and file workers with the money that you would confiscate, that's really taking all the money away from the CEOs.
Quite a loaded word.
they would get 3.5 cents an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you wanted to take Hillary and Bernie's favorite idea of capping CEO compensation by 20 to 1 ratio, which it was in 1960, the average worker would see his or her weekly pay increase by $1.32 before taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Big deal. Mm. It doesn't benefit the average guy, but unfortunately, numeracy is lost in this country.
Any interest in symbolism here, though? You know, the value of somebody saying, I will take a pay cut.
Oh, it's symbolism, and that's all.
Well, see, I would actually disagree. I mean, I'll take the two parts of that. First of all, you're absolutely right that globalization has increased prosperity at a global level. The problem is that country government still works at a national level. So even though you have prosperity increasing globally, you have inequality increasing within countries. And again, that's not just a U.S. trend. This happens a lot. I spend a lot of time in China. They're struggling with this, too. And in fact, my book's about to be published in China because they're at a very similar point politically to where we were in the 70s, where they have to make a decision as to whether to have real growth or financialized growth. But to your second question, I would actually say that that's the wrong lens. It's not about, taking the sheer amount of CEO pay and dividing it up between workers. It's about creating an ecosystem that actually supports more sustainable labor. So I would look at the Germanic model, for example, in what's called the Mittelstand companies, the small and middle-sized companies in Germany. There's an ecosystem, and this is made part, to be fair, by the fact that a lot of them are private and family-owned. They have an ecosystem where the workers, the unions, the corporate management, and civic society works together. And that's one reason that post-2008, U.S. manufacturers laid off just millions of people en masse. Germans did not. They found ways within communities to furlough people, to put them to work refurbishing factories or retraining, and wait for the economy to pick back up. When it did in 2010, they went into Asia and grabbed a lot of market share back from U.S. companies because of that. And I would say that that's a more interesting model to follow.
Is shareholder activism an issue in other countries, now that you bring up other parts of the world?
Well, it is. Certainly in the U.K. this is an issue. European countries tend to vary. They each one has a different model. The German system is interesting. I mean, the German banks actually have a lot of problems. They're very, very highly leveraged and have had a major problem since the financial crisis. But German companies do tend to have, I think, a little bit more of a sustainable model, VW aside. What's interesting is a lot of Asian countries are now at a tipping point. I actually think that the next theater of financialization will be China, because China is where the U.S. was in the 70s. They have slowing growth. They have a big question mark over how they're going to grow sustainably in the future. What will growth look like? What political shifts might need to be made to create more sustainable growth in a country that is becoming more middle class by global standards? There's a faction of the party that wants to keep the status quo and kind of throw the ball to the financial markets like we did in the U.S. And there's another part of the party that wants to do things differently. And so I think it's just very interesting to see how that's going to play out.
There's a great case study in here that really caught my eye as a railroad buff, because I'm familiar with the name Timken. They've made roller bearings for the likes of steam locomotives and other rolling stock for more than a century now, I think. And Timken is a good example of an old industrial company that got carved up by financiers, didn't it?
It did. I mean, it's just an example of this, what I think of as a short-term shareholder activism. I mean, it's funny that a lot of the people that are practicing this, the Carl Icahns, T. Boone Pickens, were called barbarians at the gates in the 1980s, when they were carving up TWA and companies like that. So there's been quite a rebranding that's gone on with shareholder activism. But it's something that every corporation, every public corporation in America faces and fears today.
And it seems like it always gets forgotten that whether the stock price is going up or down, if the company is making a profit, it's still going to pay dividends on the stocks you own.
It is. And, I would argue that sometimes these cash payouts to investors are not necessarily the best use of corporate funds. I do think dividends are smarter than share buybacks. They're less manipulative. Share buybacks used to be illegal up until 1982. And it's kind of amazing that something that was actually considered illegal market manipulation until 1982 is now standard corporate business practice, all part of financialization.
So you point out there's a revolving door between Washington and Wall Street, which certainly accounts for some of the, you call it cognitive capture, I call it regulatory capture. capture, where you have the people who are doing the regulating being the people who know the business the best, and then they end up on both sides of the same screen, essentially. We have the tools to fix it, you say. What are some of the steps we need to undertake?
Well, I think the first step is kind of what I was trying to do in my book, which is change the narrative. I think over the last 40 years, we have developed as a country a narrative that finance is the top of the economic pyramid. You know, this is what we graduate to after we go from being an agrarian society to a manufacturing country to a services economy. Then finance is at the very tippy top, and we should all want to be there, and that financial services are an end in and of themselves. But they're services. They're supposed to be helping other businesses. So I think recrafting that narrative and really kind of making a Copernican shift away from finance as the center of the economic universe is the first step.
So how, though, do you affect changes? Because they'd have to be legislative-type changes, and we're in a political system awash in money, and who's got the money but the people in the financial system? So who's going to buck that?
Absolutely. Well, you know, so two things. First of all, it's interesting that campaign finance reform has become such a big issue, and the fact that Bernie Sanders has been able to do so well off the back of this, I think, says we're at a real tipping point where people want some serious change. It's not going to be easy because you have to take on every vested interest in Washington. But if anything, this 2016 election cycle has told us people care deeply about this issue and they see the system as deeply broken. The second thing that I find fascinating is, as I said earlier, the capitalists themselves are starting to get worried about the growth paradigm. Most smart investors believe we're actually headed into a period of much lower growth in terms of asset prices, stock prices, returns on bonds, than in the last 30 or 40 years. And so they're looking to see, well, what's going on? Because eventually, whatever happens on Wall Street has to connect to what happens on Main Street. And they're saying, okay, maybe this financialization thing has gone too far. And so you see some small but important changes, like, for example, big asset managers and sovereign wealth funds are starting to think about where they could put their money, where they could put their pools of capital to do more social good and to create more underlying growth. So to the extent that the financial industry itself has started to worry about this problem, it's maybe a good thing.
Okay, and as you point out, too, that some people have taken public companies private so they didn't have to worry about the exigencies of the market and shareholders
Indeed.
And all that stuff. Makers and Takers is the book, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. Rana Faruhar wrote it and joined us today on The Exchange. Thank you so much, Rana.
Thank you.
All right, take care.